Dissolution by Stefan Molyneux, host of Free Domain, freedomain.com/donate. Chapter 18. Helen swore she would not cry as she drove home. It was her birthday tomorrow. The big 4-0. She had forgotten it completely for the moment. She felt rage against the wipers that never cleaned the goddamn window. She held the lever, spraying washer fluid uselessly over the sunlit, dusty insect graveyard that obscured her view. When she was a child, she used to look at the road and tilt her head to fly the double dots on the glass as if they were the wingtips of an airplane. For almost a year, Helen would lean her sickened head against the glass in the back seat as her parents bickered constantly in the front, turning away from their nagging, venomous profiles, watching the light and dark slide over the car as they drove past the blue sky, green trees, and grimy buildings carved with verbal filth. She would daydream that lobster-handed aliens had taken over the earth, and the flickering sunlight and shadows were the eons of liberation and tyranny. As her parents wrestled for endless control over each other, their marriage, and occasionally, terrifyingly, the road itself, so did Helen imagine mankind struggling for freedom from crustaceans in giant space helmets. And on a sunny stretch of highway, where only the skyscraping lampposts occasionally barred the sun, the darkness invisible in a blink, it was easy for Helen to believe that the final liberation had been achieved, and the helmet halo lobster lords had been banished forever. But then, one late afternoon, Helen opened her eyes to the car being swallowed up by a black tunnel. And there were no parents in the front seat, only lobster claws holding the steering wheel and strange chittering sounds as the giant insects argued, probably about the best way and place to eat her alive. And then Helen had woken screaming from her dozing, and her parents immediately started arguing about who had upset her more and why. And just listen for once, and how dare you? And I never said that, you liar, and you always, and you never, and on, and on. And Helen realized, suddenly, that she dozed because oblivion was heaven compared to bickering. And being unconscious was paradise compared to the senseless operations of her scalding senses. And she strove to doze again, to escape the endless hornet's nest of words in the front seat. And she had a vivid dream, vision really, of Grace Kelly sweeping into a shiny sports car, seeing that flawless skin stretched still tight over perfect bones, her whirlpool of coiffed hair bouncing slightly as she closed her eyes in the racing, screaming wind, her eternal future as a blinding sun forever at the center of petty asteroids, flogging her chemical images for fiat currency, a white captive in a desert slave auction, haggled over by fat, greasy men with oily foreheads and beads in their beards. And Helen vividly pictured, saw even in skin cell detail that her waking eyes could never hope to deliver, Grace Kelly's love of the mountainside that shredded her flesh from her bones. Because to be beautiful and haggled over was exhausting. And the fundamental exhaustion was to have to go along with the endless lie. The lie that she was interesting for some reason other than her looks. And both her parents were very attractive, and all it got them was bickering everywhere they went, and a little girl in the back seat who yearned for a quick death. Because dozing was better than waking, and death was just super dozing. Helen was fascinated by wounds and death. She craned her head to identify roadkill. She sat up late among the bodies of the fallen, watching gory movies during sleepovers. She would sneak medical textbooks from a friend's house and sit in the bathroom, paging through elephantine legs and tumors and eye surgeries and goiters and sebaceous cyst lancing, and feel prickles of horror that sometimes felt like the only reason her heart had to keep pumping. And when her friend Amelia showed her a slender metal nail she had pushed through the ball of her thumb, her friend Amelia, who listened to King Kurt and Echo and the Money Men and Joy Division and never ever wanted to be in a room alone with Amelia's older brother, when she showed Helen the emo drama and deep cave help bellow of cutting yourself, Helen stood on a precipice, knowing her own frail alabaster beauty, she felt merged with Amelia's thirst to destroy whatever the lying world called beautiful. And Helen felt like a priceless work of art, bought and sold to dodge taxes and fund crimes. And that liberation from evil regretfully meant destroying whatever evil called beautiful, because whatever evil lusted after always fed crimes, and to sacrifice goddesses starved evil of power. And Helen did toy with self-harm. But a strange anger, so different from Amelia's bottomless despair, possessed her. And rather than destroy herself, despite liars, she would become a flawless siren in order to rule over this serpentine world. So she turned to obsessive exercise and an eating disorder and cultivated a sunny personality and complained about tummy aches and kept mountains of stuffed toys on her bed and lost her virginity to a sweaty, desperate quarterback among the stuffed animals, feeling very much like a stuffed animal herself, but kept herself spiritually pure for a steady alpha that she only met at Wasega that blinding day on the beach. In her car, pushing 40, Helen felt another one of her rocket stages falling away. This had been happening more and more. Her scant breasts drooped. Her knee skin began to sag. Fine lines radiated from her eyes. She had regretfully given up laughter years before. And her belly protruded no matter how many sit-ups she did. Robert was getting gray and craggy and had developed cold robot crease lines along his cheeks and wore his extra weight with bulk and authority. But she was fighting her plumpness with desperate losing attrition. If she dieted, she slept poorly, which put haunted shadows under her eyes and ironed her facial skin into aging paper. If she gained a little weight, youth filled her face out somewhat, but she got neck cricks checking out her cellulite in the mirror. Her son's skin was like cream. Hers like cracked beige paint. Robert's face aged well. Helen just dried out. And battle lines had hardened between them. Robert had no respect for his wife's career. He did not roll his eyes, but he never asked questions or drilled into her difficulties. He never felt the need to woo her boss the way she had to woo Peter. His needs always came first. And yes, damn it, he did make a lot of money, but life was about more than money, Robert. Yeah, sure, I'll believe that when you stop spending. Helen gritted her teeth, staring at the hypnotic flashing of a car, BMW, of course, that had its signal on but refused to change lanes. She refused to rehash marital arguments in her mind. They led nowhere. And what was the point of trying to win an argument with a skilled lawyer with almost 15 years of experience? Trying to beat Robert in her mind inevitably led to her fantasizing about beating him with a spatula, which alarmed her by both alarming and exciting her. That little... Oh, these words had only been spoken once, but Helen heard them all the time now. That little career of yours, that little project, that little paycheck, that little meeting. Helen's job was a vain hobby to Robert. She knew that. She also knew that she couldn't torture that admission out of him. Another occasional fantasy that required high, shiny boots, a swinging light bulb, a dingy basement, and a much younger body. Just... tell me the truth, she would purr, straddling him and kissing his wounds as he wept blood and submitted. Helen blinked and shook her head suddenly as if chilled droplets had hit her inner ear. Arash, her boss, had summoned her first thing that morning. He was an Iranian. No, Persian, he always said, who was as smooth and subtle as a Japanese bullet train. Irresistible, as all truly certain people are, he had been brought up in the garment industry, sewing by candlelight even as a child, before being scooped up and transported to Canada at the age of 9. Obsessive and fastidious, he dressed to absolute perfection and lined up everything on his desk at perfect right angles. Helen would mess with his crossword pen from time to time, changing its angle slightly, but it was always fixed without complaint or comment. He was friendly in that certain manipulative Middle Eastern manner, calling people my friend and shaking their hands slowly with both of his and doing them favors and remembering their wives' birthdays, and was not beyond calling someone boss in particularly tough negotiations. And he was a servant to them and controlled them that way by making their vanity dopamine dependent on his respect and submission. Arash was very successful and flirty in a way that never quite made it to HR because he had a swarthy, intimate, pirate air to him that women preferred to complain about only to each other, rolling their eyes and touching their collarbones, rather than to the cold-eyed Karens in HR, who lived only to buzzkill whatever threatened to be enjoyable at the office. Oh, that's just Arash being Arash, they would murmur. He insisted on first names at all times, and would not even answer to Mr. Ahmadi, simply staring into space until the magic syllables were uttered, which unlocked his sparkling eyes, good graces, and grandiloquent gestures. He had only faint traces of an accent. Even when upset, his inflection rarely faltered, but he had veered more towards British phrases than coarse Canadian a's and ya's and abuts. His son was a hockey player, and Arash would shout from the cold, stacked metal pews, "Good shot!" as if his son were blasting away at skeets on a Scottish moor or languidly playing a 3-day cricket match. Helen, thank you. Yes, thank you for joining me. Arash smiled that morning as Helen entered his office. See, that was the sort of thing you could never get Arash on, joining me. It was flirty, everyone knew it, but he seemed so innocent that the liberal women, all the women it seemed, felt a slight flutter of attraction but just told themselves that they should be tolerant of his turns of phrase because he was an exotic immigrant. How are you? Can I pour you a coffee? I have new beans from Somalia, exquisite on the tongue. Helen almost laughed at the image of Arash in a sultan's outfit, spoon-feeding her Somalian coffee froth. He was hospitable to the point where you felt you might need a pregnancy test. I'm well, Arash. Helen flicked her hair back. No coffee, thanks, though. She opened her notepad, yellowed paper, leather-bound, that Arash had gifted her after picking it up at a Renaissance fair his daughter dragged him to. She had to shred her notes every night before going home. Arash sighed, settling back in his leather chair. "Ah, but this will not be needed," he murmured, waving his hand. Her senses alerted, Helen had the urge to undo a button on her blouse. She shook her head almost imperceptibly. "It has been more than 10 years since we got together during the day." He interlaced his fingertips. "Bound together in this mission to reclaim the old ways of dressing and being." "You're philosophical this morning. You should see me late at night. That is when I am truly philosophical." He leaned forward suddenly. "But I am sad today, which I now regret telling you because the news is about you." Helen blinked. "Me?" Arash, between his teeth. "Ah, you know, the business world is full of... it's hard to say, but it needs to be said, I think. We have to make money, but the mission should underpin all that. Money is the means to the mission. My late father used to tell me about the old days, the old ways in Iran before the revolution." He laughed softly. "Oh, the women had legs like giraffes, gazelles, and the men dressed as if for job interviews every day." He leaned forward, further miming eating. "My father would shave and wear a tie every day, even Sundays, after church, and eat like this because he hated any mess on his clothes." Arash laughed. "My mother used to say that if my father were to be shot, he would be more troubled by the hole in his clothing than the wound to his body. And I do love this civilization represented by this office. It may be a losing mission to fight against," his lips curled, "casual Fridays and business casual, but it is a fight worth going down for. You cannot really say a harsh word in fine clothing. Women don't nag in wide-brimmed hats. Have you ever seen a child running wild in a restaurant if he and his parents are well-dressed? Fine clothes are the soft skin of civilization itself. They remind us to be more than animals, to approach the platonic, the angelic, and to have thoughts and actions worthy of our apparel. You know, I once spent a day in sweatpants as an experiment and ended up eating a whole bag of Doritos and wiping my hands on my behind, I'm sorry to say. I went from man to animal in a single day." Arash shuddered. "Oh, never again. I would sleep in a suit if I could. It would give me more civilized dreams." Helen nodded slowly. She quite enjoyed his ramblings. She got paid either way. Arash sighed deeply. "And you have been..." Helen's ears pricked up. "Past tense? An intimate part of that mission. You have a flawless clothing sense and a magnificent way of displaying those clothes. You are a credit to apparel, yourself and me, of course. I love the clothes, of course, to the degree that my wife long ago gave up on jealousy. But I am rambling and being a coward." Helen said nothing. Her heart was pounding. "How is Robert?"
"Well, he's good."
"And his career? I saw him in the paper 3 weeks ago?"
"Yes."
Helen never said yeah around Arash. "He's going from strength to strength." "Excellent. And the boys? How is your lineage? They are well, strong?"
"Yes, thank you."
"Good. That gives me some peace." Arash sighed again. "I tried my best, Helen. It is all these damnable computers." Arash was the only person Helen had ever heard use the word damnable. "You have always talked it travel agents, hotel clerks. You put me on a conveyor belt from strength to strength. I hope you have always felt appreciated for that, Helen.
Helen swallowed. I have, thank you.
So, of course, there are all these new websites and programs for scheduling and managing appointments. It was my daughter that told me the minx. Why are you so old-fashioned? She keeps wanting to know.
Arash leaned forward conspiratorially.
She wears sweatpants when I am not home. I see it when I come home early. I would rather she were...
He waved his hand.
No, that thought is unworthy. The tweed forbids it. But these vendors keep pestering me, and they presented to the board last month, and we have a little Iraqi who has run all the numbers and made all the promises, and we don't need 10 support agents.
Arash always called her an agent.
We only need 2. Am I? Yes. Let go. I am so sad to say.
Arash got up and started making a coffee using the small gunmetal machine on his desk.
Even if you don't drink it, indulge me for making it.
8 of us are going?
Well, I should not speak of the others, of course, but your math is spot on.
But, Arash, it's been 13 years.
You dress, Robert. We've socialized together, like, countless times. We go to Vegas. I've constantly been poached, recruited. I've never even looked at another boss. I know. This is like a breakup. But Robert is doing well, and you have recruiters eyeing you from the wings. This should give us both comfort.
Helen was about to speak, but Arash held up his hands.
It is a sad day, my friend. I love the numbers in fashion, but not in business. But we all answer to someone. I have these bean counters. They say we can save $1 million a year. That is a lot. I hate translating people into fabric, but that is a lot of clothing. 2 stores in good locations. And if we do not take this money, it is lying on the table. Others will, and do better over time. And then we are all on the streets, and bad clothing takes over, and we all get buried in sweatpants and Doritos. I cannot lose the mission without a fight, my dear Helen. And I did fight for you, and you know that I did. But also I have not helped you by making you write everything on paper and avoid computers. But I have seen so many lawsuits, and I am in the downward slide of life. So everyone knows that you have no computer skills, which is my fault. And the new hires, well, they are less than half your cost. And I have to get a cell phone. It is a tragedy, but perhaps this liberates you to do even more with your life. I have been most selfish over the years, Helen. I have kept you for reasons of great affection. We both know that you could rule the world like your namesake of old instead of trailing after me at conferences and reminding me of my obligations. I always try, and I get this from my father as well, to look at problems as opportunities. Why not start your own company, Helen? You're more than capable. Or take an MBA and rule some kingdom. Why should Robert have all the...
He pushed the tiny coffee cup forward and shook his head.
No, I will not speak anything against our good friend Robert. Helen, how is your heart, my friend?
The swarthy kindness, the gentle directness, caused Helen's ice people heart to sweat sudden sorrow.
I'm shocked. Sad. It's a lot to take in.
Yes.
And perhaps you can take some time to enjoy your children before they flee the nest.
Their teenage years are like the toddler years. You have to watch everything.
And Robert is doing well. This could be a good time to reassess.
Ah, but I hate that I'm giving you advice. It could be seen as me believing that you cannot think of these things yourself.
Arash's soft voice trailed off. his dark chocolate eyes narrowing slightly with medieval concern. He sat in stillness and patience.
Helen took a deep breath. When does this all take effect?
Arash spread his hands expansively.
The computer beasts are all ready to go. We don't need you to stay and train anyone. We have a generous severance, of course. Though I lost the big war, I won this much. You can stay if you want, but there is no real need. Take the time, take the money, reassess, regrow, realign. Think of this as a liberation, my dear.
Helen felt sudden anger in her chest, rage almost. She had an urge to fling the tiny, hot, frothy coffee cup at Arash's perfect beard.
My dear, repeated Arash, drawing back slightly. You are upset?
Helen took a deep breath, fighting for self-control. Scraps of useless protest flew through her mind, falling unspoken from her lips like tossed baby birds bouncing down a cliffside.
I don't know what to say.
Arash nodded. She could see immigrant tales of hardship and opportunity forming in his throat. But somehow, for once, he restrained himself.
Again, I am sorry. No, it's... I just need a moment. And some privacy, I fear, said Arash, decisively, the steely CEO soul emerging in a flash.
He stood and crossed his office to the ornate door.
Take the room for as long as you need. Use my phone if you need.
Arash closed the door. With relief, Helen could see, or imagine, she wasn't sure which. Stung by a sudden compulsion to move, Helen stood up, walked around the desk, and settled into Arash's plush chair, scowling at the residual warmth. She pictured dictating to a younger version of herself, bringing her along, grooming her, sharing secrets and gossip. She imagined men filing past her desk, wanting and promising and betraying her in equal measure. She imagined having a beard and balls and a hairy carpet chest and assuming control without having to manipulate or be attractive or... And here her imagination faltered, and a sudden lump formed in Helen's throat. Who am I without my looks? She had sailed into Arash's employment on charm and humor and his obvious appreciation of her looks. The women who worked for him referred to themselves as his harem. Helen was called the first wife. Men appreciated a pretty face. This was not a sexual risk for the most part, although one manager had to be fired after literally stalking Helen and taking pictures of her inside her home. She had the power to please men, to raise their status and thus their income, and for this she had been paid mightily. Too much. This had always been a risk. She was paid to be pretty. Her subsidy was fading, and she was falling back to the position of having to compete with younger women. Was this the source of her rage? She was certain that the two new women were younger, prettier, and thus conveyed higher status. Helen was no longer a hot young thing, but a sort of faded auntie. Her pay was no longer prestige, but charity. Who am I without my looks? Well, I can still be a trophy, but my boss would have to be 90 or so. The image of Anna Nicole Smith arose in her mind, and Princess Diana for the first time in years. Who defers to me when I am fading? What is a watercolor worth after a day in the washing rain?
Ah, it was all too pathetic, too poetic. She wasn't a fractured statue or a stained ball gown. She was just aging. Replaceable. Mortal.